Southwest Fire Academy was established in 2015 as a response to the recognized need for quality, safe, and affordable fire and rescue training in Ontario. This is not your average fire college. SFA has high standards for their students, and it is their mission to teach and produce qualified, ambitious firefighters who are prepared to work hard to serve their communities. This is not a diploma mill. This is where you can learn strategic, aggressive firefighting from passionate, intelligent instructors who never forget why they were made to do this job. SFA is an accredited private career college that is regulated by the Ministry of Training, colleges, and universities, with a memorandum of understanding with the Office of the Fire Marshal. This means that SFA is an approved training provider with the OFM, and the programs are recognized in Ontario. Check out the pre-service and expanding selection of course offerings at southwestfireacademy.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 83 of Multiple Calls. I'm Scott Hewlett. Conversations matter more than ever. We are witnessing daily their power to unite or tear apart. Short or long form, well-intentioned, mutually respectful, and forgiving conversations allow us at best to learn, grow, and create, and at a minimum, to coexist. The problem is, we are imperfect in how we receive, process, and convey information. There wouldn't be classes, books, videos, and podcasts dedicated to communication if it happened flawlessly and effortlessly. It's a learned and perishable skill. We also don't always get a choice in the who, what, when, where, and why when it comes to conversations, but we can keep trying to do better in how we handle them when we must in those most difficult of situations. In the fire service, when we do get a choice to engage, a couple of our best have offered some words of advice. Don't listen to the mutts when they bark, Lieutenant Brad Clark. And mutts don't scrap. Battalion Chief Corley Moore.
Kick it off by telling me about where you grew up and tell me a bit about your family.
I have a very unique upbringing. My father is a unique individual, very unique person. He was a missionary to Australia when I was age 1 to 2, basically. So I grew up a little, I don't remember any of it, but there's pictures of me wrestling and like with baby kangaroos and stuff. Then he came back and he was heavily involved in politics here in Oklahoma. And he became a state senator shortly thereafter. He did that for a short bit. So he never did anything for long. So he always chased a new thing. And then he built a boat. That doesn't really do it justice because it was a 44-foot ocean sailor that he built from the ground up to go do missionary work in the South Seas. But we spent a lot of my younger years, especially like I want to say from like ages 10, 11, 12, I'm guessing, traveling the country as he spoke at different churches every week trying to raise money for the boat. So very unique is the fact that we would drive from one city to the next city, preaching at a new church each week. That's what we did.
Did you spend time on the boat then, traveling with him as well?
He finished it up, and that was about the time it took was about the cycle of time for a new project. So the boat is now, it was donated to a missionary in Fiji, and that person went on, and it's out there floating around and doing its thing. But we never saw the completion. And that's one of my own things that I inherited from my father's the ISTP personality, and that is that you get infatuated with a problem, but you don't really care about the solution. You just need to know if you can figure it out. So once you figure it out, you don't really care to actually finish doing it. You just say, oh, okay, this will work. Okay, what's next?
And totally process oriented.
Oh yeah, this will work. This will be super successful. I don't care anymore. Now what's next?
Well, I'm glad you haven't done that with the podcast.
The scrap is one of the few things that's really escaped that trap and been consistent. So that's unusual for even me.
So how was school for you then growing up if you were traveling around so much?
A lot of homeschool in the younger years. We did it on the road, basically. Luckily, through high school, I got to actually attend actual traditional school and play traditional sports. So that was, I feel like, a big formative part of my young life.
So did you have sort of a Christian upbringing, Christian schooling?
Very much so. Very religious based. He's a Baptist preacher through and through. Didn't have a TV for a lot of growing up. Just a lot of the typical Southern, I would say Bible Belt upbringing.
Did you go into secondary education after high school?
Only secondary education was EMT.
Okay. Where'd you take that in the state?
Just local community college. I had the National Registry, but I kept it for quite a while until it was no longer required to be kept, and I let it slide and never picked it back up.
So then what about sports and hobbies as a kid? If you were traveling around, that might be tough too.
I love, and I have always loved, American tackle football. Like, it is a passion since I was a kid. I would play football. I was literally the kid that would throw the football to himself and play against myself in the backyard, front yards at churches or whatever, you know, insert whatever. And I loved it. When I got to play Little League, when we were in one area for long enough, I'd play Little League, and then I played all through high school.
It's always amazed me how big high school and college football are in the States, even bigger, say, than the NFL.
Especially like here in Oklahoma, we don't have a professional team. Cowboys are to the south of us, the Chiefs are to the north of us, but there is no team here. So the Sooners are the de facto professional team, University of Oklahoma.
Do you have an NFL team that you follow?
The Redskins, which they no longer call the Redskins, but I love John Riggins, number 44. That's the reason I wore number 44 in Little League, was because of John Riggins, running back for the Washington Redskins in early 1980s. They were winning Super Bowls. They were dominant. Joe Gibbs was there. Joe Theismann. I mean, it was Art Monk, Charlie Brown, Darryl Green, all of my heroes. And then so I was sold and completely 100% a Redskins fan for life. And now they haven't done anything in like 32 years worth mentioning.
Yeah, like the Toronto Maple Leafs.
They're just perennial disappointments. I did take my son from age 4. We would travel to Dallas and watch the Redskins play the Cowboys every year. That was as close as they were, 3.5 hours away. We did that for 17 years. And I kind of just fell off on the whole kneeling for the anthem thing and all the politicization of the sport and the changing of the name and all of that stuff. It just kind of soured me completely. And for the last few years, I've just kind of fallen off of not really caring about football as much as I used to.
Right. Even university and high school?
No, I still love following OU. I'll probably always be a Sooner fan.
Yeah. So how about friend group growing up? If you were traveling a lot too, that's tough.
It's what I call a lot of single serving friends. Every week was a new church, and there was always kids our age, me and my siblings, that you had to meet and get to know and have the awkward and say, okay, now we're best friends for a couple of days, and now we're traveling to the next church, and we'll never see you again. So it was a lot of cycling of disposable friendships or whatever you want to call it, acquaintances.
Were you influenced at all to follow in his footsteps, or were you always thinking of something different?
That's a great question. I don't know. Because there's a lot of what he does, I do. And so he's influenced me heavily. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think I've ever been interested in being a preacher or religious in any sense.
A sense of community, obviously, and connection with people. That's something probably that you've tied into your life.
I would say that's fair. I don't know if I've ever actually delved into the, with any sort of intentionality, delved into the psychoanalytics of of his impact on my personality.
So how do you get exposed to the fire service then? Like, how did that come along?
That was actually my father. And it was, I was 19. I graduated high school when I was like 16 years old. And long story, but not the point. So I'd been out of high school for a few years. I was married. I had a kid. I was working jobs that had absolutely no future whatsoever other than hourly wages and showing up. And my father was working, of course, preaching at a church. And they had a local fire chiefs. Was going to the Sunday school that he was teaching, and they became close, and he said, yeah, we're hiring. And so my dad told me about it, and I was like, okay, I'll try out. I'll go get my EMT if that's what he says I should do. And my first exposure, probably what really put it on my map, was playing football when I was 16 years old, and I broke my tib fib. It was an open fracture, but nasty thing. It was actually a pretty clean fat fracture until I tried to stand up.
Oh, Jesus.
But the firefighters that showed up and the EMT that showed up, I still remember this day, him saying, hey, kid, you ever done this before? And I was like, no. And he said, neither have I. Don't worry about it. And I still remember that to this day. Just I wonder how many people he's been on that had trauma or whatever, and how many people he'd use that same line on. You know what I'm saying?
To lighten it a little bit.
Right. And but that did have that impact on me where I was like, that was a really cool experience for me outside the pain and the broken leg. But that part of the experience was really cool. And I think it stuck with me quite a bit and was one of the reasons I was so interested in trying to do it when it got on the radar.
So then you were interested in trying out. So EMT was the first part of the process. Like, walk me through to getting pinned and you're on the truck?
It was kind of my dad pushing me because, like I said, I was working a dead end job. Or not, I don't want to say a dead end job. It was just a typical hourly wage job that if you don't work, you don't get paid type. But long story short, he talked to that chief. The chief said, hey, if he's interested, he needs to do this, 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 and this. And the biggest thing is getting your EMT. At the time, that was huge. They didn't really have the requirements for firefighter one and two to apply at that point. The fire service here, I'm sure everywhere, goes in cycles. It's like they'll hire people that come out of the trades and construction when they can find them. And then they're like, oh, wait, we're getting too many of these guys. We need to hire brainiacs that can pass written tests. Oh, we need these guys with certs. Oh, we need to get some guys that are physical and have some, we need to get them out of the trades and sports. And so when I hit 97, they had just hit a point where they were hiring people who were doing really well, like on test taking. And that was a heavy weighted part of the process. And I was at the time, even though I never went to any sort of college or university, I had done a lot of ACT prep work and ACT tests trying to get ready to do that because I didn't know what I was doing. So when I took the firefighter test, I think I scored a 97. I was number two on the test out of like 600 people. Like I said, it was just right in my wheelhouse that I hit in that cycle of the kind of the hiring process. Because shortly after that, they switched over to let's get people with certs, you know, and they change it around. And so if I'd hit that one, I would have no shot. And I always tell people everything happens for a reason. I believe that. And I was never a person that's like, I'm going to be a firefighter. That is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try and try and try until I make it. If I hadn't gotten hired that first time, I'd probably be still working at that same job or similar. I don't know how it would played out, but I was supposed to get hired then. It wasn't like if I failed, I was going to say, oh, well, I'll try again. I'll try again. No, it was supposed to be.
Did you enjoy the EMT program, even though it wasn't something you thought of, like you just had to get it?
I'm not an EMS guy. I'll open up with that. It's not something I'm passionate about at all. In fact, I think there's a lot of the EMS that is bled into the fire service that is weakened to the fire service and its mission. And I'm passionate about that. But I think that what's so alluring about it is just you never know what you're going to go on. It's always challenging. It's always people at their worst, not at their human being worst. I'm just saying people in the worst situations of their lives usually are calling and the EMTs are showing up first to deal with it. So the stuff you can deal with is always fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I love that aspect of it. And I think that's what's so alluring about it. And one of the reasons people get into it, it attracts that type of personality that loves to deal with those kind of things.
Yeah, and there's areas that the medics can't go into right away, so it requires us to have strong BLS, maybe even getting into some ALS skills in some areas. Like you think about a trench rescue or a confined space or a hazmat call, right, where the medics can't go. So it's still incumbent on us, I guess, to have some. We can't dismiss the medical side of things completely. And we don't cut empty cars apart either. So if we do a great job cutting the car apart and
I don't want to downplay the rescue aspect at all of the fire rescue service. I don't want to downplay it at all, but
that wasn't where you were strongly leaning.
Right.
Yeah. The department that you got on, they were asking for you to have your EMT to start. So were you cycling between engine, truck, ambulance? How did that rotation work?
Okay. So I don't know the American Fire Service at this time. I'm a 19-year-old kid who got on and I thought every place operated the way my department operated. But we are a suburban fire department, four stations. We have four crews that run out of those stations. There is no double houses. And the ladder trucks we have are Quints. And we just hop back and forth from the engine to the ladder, depending on where the call drops. And so we cross staff those. And we do not do ambulance service. It's private contract with the city. We show up on all the EMT calls.
So that's why they expected you to have that to start?
Right. Everybody is an EMT, but we don't actually run the medic service. We show up and assist the medic service.
What was the recruit program like? How did they shape you up to get on the trucks?
It was a growth in progress when I got there. And it was going from, and it's been the story of my department and my career, basically, it's always been growing from about the time I hired on, going from the small town department big town department into small city department, if that makes sense. It's kind of making that transition. Some of the systems in place to make the place run relied heavily on, well, that guy does this and this guy does that, and turning into more getting these positions and responsibilities assigned to those responsible for them instead of just, oh, he takes care of air packs and he takes care of that kind of thing. So it was the transition from small town or big town to small city. And that's always been there. So the training division at the time was done by people on duty. And it had just, when I hired on, my class was the second class that, no, I think it might be the first class that moved to training majors, which is what we called them at the time, training majors that were on shift that dealt with nothing but the recruit academy. I'll put it, it was a very new experience for the department and for the recruits. And I love my department. Do not get me wrong. I love them with all my heart and soul. And I'll tell some of the funny stories about it. But I remember one day there were six of us recruits and we showed up to the training center where we trained. It was a classroom that we reported to, and we all reported in there, and there was no training major there. And so we sat in our desk at attention waiting, or like, they're testing us. Everybody read your books. They're testing us. And we sat there all morning and studied because we're like, and then finally it was like getting close to lunch. And so finally someone picked up the phone and called the admin and said, "Hey, do you want us to take a lunch?" And they were like, "Just ask your training major." And we said, "Well, we don't have one." The thing was, he was off that day, but they hadn't really quite yet worked out exactly the system. No one knew there was no training major there. And we were just recruits sitting there waiting with no. So it was kind of the raw early bugs that were getting worked out as they prepared us. But no, very good class. Like I said, it's all I knew. And it was other than football, it was the first structured stuff in my life that was assigning me responsibility.
How were the rookie years then? Did you feel overwhelmed, or was it kind of like ignorance is bliss? Or
I always tell people I grew up in the fire service. I really did. And I came from, and I don't want to sound cocky, but I was always the smartest person. I was always really good at sports. And I went from being one of the best in everything I did, very big fish in a small pond, because my pond was tiny, okay? And I went from that to, you're nothing and you don't know anything. And it was true, although I didn't know it. I grew up in the fire service. And in all truth, I probably should have been terminated during my rookie year, because I was not mature enough to take it serious as it needed to be taken. And I don't say that lightly, but I like I said, everything happens for a reason. My chief, when I was assigned on shift, my chief was having hypertension issues and had been put off duty. And then the next guy in charge had gotten off a rig and ripped his shoulder up and was off getting rehab and surgery and whatnot. So the two top people on my shift, and so I actually skated through based off the chaos of the lack of leadership at the time. Although if they had been in place, they probably would have terminated my employment and I would not have made it through my probationary year.
Just because you came in hot, like because of your attitude?
I don't think I was cocky. They may disagree, but it was a lackadaisical. I would fall asleep at inopportune times. There's a plethora of Corley stories in my rookie year that I'm not proud of, but they're my past and I'll acknowledge them.
Having that puts even personally a lot of things in perspective and contrast, and you can speak more directly to what you see of that today and what the journey out of that is, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's one of my strengths is, A, I have a high degree of grace for people. I'm very big on you can pass judgment or you can have grace. And there's a lot of people who love to pass judgment, and there's a time and a place for it. Don't get me wrong. There's accountability for a reason. But when you have the option for grace or judgment, I choose grace almost every time because, like I said, I made it through. And I'm not saying that's always the best option, because some people just need the good slap, but proverbial. And the other part of it is I've been complacent. I've been extremely complacent. I've reported to duty. Again, this isn't, not proud of this in any way, shape, or form, but I've been one of the people that showed up and said, what's the least amount we can do today and still keep our jobs, right? Just not saying that out loud, but that's the whole attitude. And I understand what breeds that and where that comes from. So I have a high degree of empathy for people who have fallen into that trap. And that's another part that I'm not super judgmental when it comes to that. I have a high, like I said, I have a high degree of empathy for saying, man, I've been there. I understand why you think this isn't my emergency. I understand why you say, I get paid the same whether we go to a fire or not. All those attitudes that creep in and take over, and they're very toxic, but I understand where they're born and where they come from.
But yet you still have a high amount of urgency and intentionality behind how it can't stay that way.
Don't get me wrong. I've always, always, always loved fire and going to fires, and even emergency scenes in general, just the chaos of it, and that we show up and we are the order bringers to the chaos. Now, the degree of effectiveness to that all ties back into our preparation and all the stuff that I'm passionate about. I always love that part, but that doesn't mean I've always been as plugged in or as passionate about everything as I should have been.
So what woke you up? Did you have a self-realization, or did people around you shake that out of you?
I think it was a process. I don't think there was a moment, although I can point at certain key things that I always discuss. I think, first of all, just maturation of just growing up. I think that's part of it, just getting a little more wisdom with a little more years and realizing, they say you don't know shit till you're 30. I thought that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then really, you hit 40 and you look back and you go, wow, I really thought I knew something at 30. And I'm sure that will continue
every decade
as I grow older.
Yeah.
But I think the maturation process is just to be part of kids. Having my kids, I had my kids very young, and them growing up and watching them and become and being responsible for them, not as young, but just throughout the years. Again, part of the maturation process. It was also the culture of the department. And again, I love my department. I'm not speaking ill of them, but there was a time when the culture of the department was whoever could do the least during the day was the winner. And the goal of your career was to get promoted, not promoted, but make it out to the slow station so you could make as little rides as possible. That was the culture. And there was a reasons for that. And I understand. And there was the people that came before me, and they fought battles to make the department the way it was when I got there. They fought battles to get things like rigs that ran and get pay that was comparable. They fought hard battles to get days off and good working hours. And they fought battles to get equipment that actually met standards. And they did all these things, and I hired into that. So all that stuff had been fought for. So I came in and then over time, and I was like, wait a second, we don't train here. We don't. And they had already won their battles. And so I have a high respect for them, but then and it took me a while to realize that, but there's many that did a lot for the department to get it to where it was. And then of course it has to keep continuing to progress. And I'm sure there's kids that'll come in behind me and be like, well, why is it just where this isn't good enough? And then I'll feel slighted. I'll feel slighted the way the old dogs before me felt slighted when we said the same thing. And that'll be the cycle that continues.
So did the job find you at all during those complacent times? Were there any wake up moments on jobs, or were the fire gods pretty gentle?
No, I never got into a jam up because of the complacency. There's some hairy moments. I don't know. That's a good question. Would they have been as hairy if I'd have been more prepared?
Or maybe things were happening around you and you were ignorant to it and didn't recognize it.
I don't know how much was just luck. Honestly, in hindsight, looking back, saying, were we just accidentally lucky and good? You know what I mean by we weren't actually good, just accidentally lucky.
Yeah, I know. I asked that because I have that looking back now of learning something 15 years in and going, oh my God, I look back at that call and think I had no idea what was actually happening. I was actually in danger, and not until I wish I would have known this to react to it, but I just skated it.
Now, and some of it too, I think, is also just, I don't think it would have changed because we were on the high pressure hose, combination nozzles, 30 degree attack. You don't put water on it until you get to the seat of the fire, crawling in under the heat. And we were on as the fire environment has changed, and we now understand smoke is fuel, and we're crawling through diesel. We need to cool as we go, all that. So the education, I think, was just as important as the mindset of complacency as far as getting to low pressure hose, getting to smooth bores and straight stream application of water and cooling the environment, cooling surfaces, all of that stuff that we just didn't know back then. We didn't know what we didn't know.
How did you get involved in instructing? Because going from a sort of a complacent mindset to being an instructor, that's a large leap.
Part of the same process is around, I want to say 2016. So it wasn't that long ago in the grand scheme of my career. I had like 18, 19 years on at the time. Mark Von Oppen came. Brian Brush, who lives very close to me, brought Mark Von Oppen in to our area to teach. And I went to go get to see him. And I was blown away. Oh, like, you can love this job and be good at it and be passionate about it and be like, no, this is what I do. I fucking love this. And it blew my mind. I still have that notepad of the notes I took that day. And I love his blog. In fact, his blog, which blogs were about dying about 2016 area. Blogs were basically passe and gone. But I loved his blog, so I started the Firehouse Vigilance blog shortly thereafter. I think 2017 is when I started the blog. I would publish my thoughts and my ideas on that. And I loved it, man. And that was one of those moments that is a catalyst for me that I do point at and say, Mark Von Oppen. In fact, he wrote an article that basically said the key to fighting complacency is to remain ever vigilant. And that's where the term vigilance comes from, in the firehouse vigilance, a never-ending fight against complacency. And it's Mark Von Oppen. And so he's one of my idols. Love him. So that's the big reason. And then I went to a conference. I was super pumped up, and I went to a conference. And there was an instructor there who spoke, and it was terrible. And this is not me trying to be judgmental or catty. It was terrible. I don't want to say it was just complete lack of preparation, because he had videos and stuff he wanted to talk about, but it was
more self-absorbed, like in his own head.
Self-absorbed and unaware that how bad it was. It was just this. I was looking around the room, and I talked some of my guys to go with me. I had other people there, and I was mad about that. So that played.
Right, into you dragged it, them to have their first conference experience, and they're like, this is what this is.
Yeah, are you serious? This is good,
right?
But I found myself actually getting angry in the room. And I was like getting, I had, in fact, on that notepad, because I keep all my notepads, I started writing on there like The Shining. Corley, you can learn something from everyone. Corley, you can learn something from, and I wrote it like 40 times on there just to try and calm myself down. But I was like, no, this is the, in my head, I'm going, this is the problem in the American Fire Service. We go to shitty instruction and no one says anything. We sit there through shitty hazmat tech refreshers, crappy EMT refreshers. We sit there through stuff we're mando told to go to, and it's all terrible, and there's no accountability, and no one tells the instructor. And I was getting mad, right? And then I was thinking about going to the bathroom and just leaving, but I'd invited all the people that were there with me, and I couldn't do that. I was wearing a shirt that represented my department, and so I didn't want to do that. So we finally took a break, and during the break, the instructor came up to me, and he said, hey, what do you think, right? And in that moment, I said, that's pretty good. Just completely bald-faced, lied to him. And I realized, you're just as much a part of the problem as everybody else. This guy was, I think, probably trying to do his best. It was terrible. The rest of the day, I sat there and said, wait a second. Maybe it's not as easy as you think it is.
Fair.
Maybe it's tougher to make a class than you're sitting here thinking it's so easy. And so instead, I started the rest of that class. The last 2 hours of the day or whatever, I just wrote down my thoughts on what makes a good class. And if I built one, what I would do. And then that next week, I ordered books off Amazon. Nancy Duarte, if anybody wants to know, Nancy Duarte is an amazing person on how to build a presentation or a speech. Her books Resonate and Slideology. Man, if you want to be good, read the books, apply the principles. It will make you a better person at instructing. So long story short, I got those books. I built my first presentation, which was over the Beacon Street fire in Boston. And I built it just to study it and to have, A, it hadn't happened that long ago at the time. And B, there was an audio that someone posted on Twitter of the radio traffic that's just bone chilling almost. And so I took that and built it's about a 20-minute presentation on what happened and what they tried to get done and the problems from outside looking in, not being a part of it, And that was the very first presentation I ever built, and I showed it to my department, and we talked about how we could apply the rules learned, and that was the very first thing I ever did, and that's how I got started, actually, was my anger saying, well, if you think you think it's so easy, do it yourself.
You know, it's a very mature way to look at it.
It was a moment of truth when he came up and said, what do you think? And I said, hey, pretty good. That was the real catalyst.
And you felt like you weren't being authentic or true to yourself.
I was basically a dirty liar at that point. I'd betrayed my own anger in that moment.
Which is a tough moment, because you think you're being a good person and doing a good thing because you're not cutting somebody down. So it justifies it as this moral thing to do, but it actually is a disservice, like you said, to yourself and to that person, right? I mean, feedback is supposed to be feedback.
Right. No, and it's a toxic compassion is what it is. It's toxic compassion.
Toxic compassion. Yeah, I like that.
And one part is I realized, because I went on to build the 9Ls class. That was the first thing I ever built, was the 9Ls class. The first real, besides just little one-offs, was the 9Ls class. It's a four-hour class. It's a behemoth of slides, and it's awesome. I love it. I'm proud of it. But not the point. Rob Fisher came and saw the 9Ls just a couple of years ago. And I love Rob Fisher, one of my favorite people on the planet. I consider him a good, good friend. He gave me his feedback when it was over. And I don't want to say he was hypercritical. He was very candid and he was very open. And I've talked about this a few times, but it was some of the most constructive, best criticism I've ever received. But I also realized this, it's because we have such a tight relationship. And I know that his feedback is only trying to improve. It's only trying to make improvements. It's not, there's no agenda for it at all other than helping. And I think that's key. Like in the moment when I was with that instructor that was so terrible, and he asked me that question, I didn't have a relationship with him that I could leverage into honest and candid feedback. Now, I could have been more honest. I didn't have to lie to his face. I didn't have to do that. But I don't think it was I don't think with a stranger, it's the time for super candid feedback.
Or there would be a way to build, you probably have that now. You have a language built to give feedback to somebody that you're very close with. And then you probably now have a language to give to somebody that you don't know very well.
I don't know if I'm that nuanced yet. But I will give anybody honest feedback, because I think gushing, flowery feedback is worthless. And I mean that, like when people say, oh, that was a great class, best class I've ever taken. Man, I love hearing it. My ego loves hearing it. It makes me feel good. Don't get me wrong. But it is utterly worthless for the improvement of the class.
Just like post-fire talks.
Yes, absolutely. You need the honesty. You need the candidness, or they're worthless.
It can all be ass slaps and high fives.
Right. Someone read a rough draft of the new book that's almost done. It's almost done. It's just like the book that never ends, but it's almost done. And they gave the review of it was, this is the best relationship book I've ever read. And I'm like, man, okay. Hey, I know that's not true. And I think it's good. And the hyperbole doesn't help. And there's nothing to, okay, well then I guess we can ship it. I'm sorry I asked you to read it now at this point. And I don't mind the compliments. Don't take me wrong. It's a great compliment, but that doesn't help the book. Anyway, I hope that makes sense without sounding ungrateful, because I'm not. I love the compliments.
Yeah, and I think you, like I said, you got a language for communicating outwardly to other people about what you think. You also start to recognize, you get to a point where you realize when honest, good feedback is honest. And you can kind of parse the two, right? You can understand, well, that was just a flower thing to say. They were trying to be nice, or if they say something and it resonates, to be speaking about resonating, like things can resonate where someone says something really good to you and you take it to heart.
The best stuff is when it punches you and makes your defenses fire. Like that's the best stuff. And then the key for it being productive is if you can take the punch and then go, wait a second, look in the mirror, hold on. Oh, wait, they're right. That's the key to the whole thing. Because if your defense is just fire, you're like, well, I did it this way because that's the way I do this and this and this and this and this. They don't understand and they don't get it. Then the feedback's worthless. But if you can reflect on it and actually apply it, that's the key.
So just have a critical mind for whatever feedback it is, if it's good or bad, and being able to find its place.
It's not about them. It's about, I won't say that. It almost sounds backwards, because it is, but it's about how you receive it. It's not about what they're actually doing. I've never actually thought this deep into it. That's pretty good.
So then how was the experience for you actually becoming an instructor? So you had, from the cheap seats, you had an opinion, you had some thoughts, you start building some things, you start getting up in front of people. Walk me through, like, from then till now about what that growth's been like for you.
I'm very blessed, okay? I'm very blessed and lucky. And A, I take after my father. Like I said, early on, I have a lot of traits that he has. He's a very meticulous person. He's a detail-oriented person that, and I wish I had that same sometimes, but not the point. Without getting into it, anything he does right. One of my favorite stories is me and him, we built my house where my parents live. It's a lake property. We built a house on it. It's their dream home. It's where they're going to spend their rest of their lives. Beautiful house. Like, it's, my dad doesn't do anything that's just like a box. So this thing has gables and out protrudings and balconies. And it's not a giant house by any stretch of the imagination. It's like maybe 1,500 square feet total. Two-story bungalow right on the lake. But it looks like a Pollyanna house with all the work and detail work. But I told, we have a what's called C-shift day at the lake. And my crew comes out to my parents' property and we spend the day playing volleyball and barbecuing and whatnot. And I gave the instructions on how to get there. And I said, you'll get there. It's a house me and my dad built. So when you get there, that was the instructions I gave. And one of the young guys pulled up to the place and he said, no, this can't be it. He said him and his dad built it, right?
Right.
Because it is that, it's like really that impressive of a, and it's all my dad's detail work. But so I say all that to say this, one of the things I learned from is that if you're going to do something, do it right. And so the reason I didn't just go and say, I'm going to build my own class. I went and I really did deep. That's what I do, is I deep dive into how do you do it right. And that's the reason for the love of Nancy Duarte. I follow so many Instagram pages on how to build slides, the PowerPoint hacks and things like that, because it is an art. It's a labor. It's a labor to build a good class. It's content isn't enough. And there's so many people out there with great content and worthwhile content, but content is not enough to instruct. And I wish more people understood that, because you can't just, like, those organizations, the teaching organizations that are like, hey, call us, we'll send you an instructor. And they send the instructor, and the instructor's like, hold on, they sent me a PowerPoint. Hold on, let me plug it in so I can read it to you, because they haven't seen it. So anyway, all that being said, a lot of the hatred I had for that stuff played into, I want to say that 9Ls probably has building the class, I would say, if not thousands, it has 800 hours of work put into the slides, the timing, the content, the delivery, and the evolution over time of it. And so all that being said, I said all that to say this, is that from the very first time I started teaching, the classes have been super well received, because they're not built like any other classes that people put on. And I say that very, very proudly. I don't want it to come across like cocky. It's just no one works that much on them that I know of. I'm sure there's others out there.
Yeah, there's definitely, to speak to you saying the quality of the instruction, like how important that is. There's a difference between like if you gave me your presentation and I just read it, having instructed enough, I'd read it and I'd know how good it is. There wouldn't be any benefit to someone just reading it to me, unless you're taking it in an audible version and you're doing it yourself. But there is a difference with the person themselves delivering the program that they put their heart into.
And I will say this, like, if I could give a badass instructor my entire PowerPoint, all like the 9Ls, I think is 922 slides. And I know I say that and people are like, holy crap. It's part of the running joke at the beginning of the class when I introduced the class. I'm like, good news, bad news. What do you want to hear? I said, the good news is this one has 922 slides. And I say that because I like to see everybody's faces fall. I like to see their stomachs drop. I said, but the bad news is this. If you actually count the number of animations and everything else, it's probably closer to 1,100. So, and it is. It's an experience. I'll put it that way. But my point is, I could give it to a great instructor, and I think it'd be worthless to him, because the slides have nothing to read, really. They are all animations and illustrations of points that I'm making. And so you could click through them and be like, I'm not sure why there's a stick man here, and I'm not sure why there's an arrow going through him, but we'll talk about situational awareness or whatever, you know, whatever the point of the slide is.
Yeah, I think what students in classes could start to appreciate too is that not everything can be delivered in three slides. And obviously some points you can make in three slides, but if you're really going to learn something, you're not looking for fast food. If you want to read something epic, you read or watch The Lord of the Rings, right? Like that story can't be told in one small novel. So if you really want something impactful that's going to resonate and people are going to take something from it and they're going to change, you got to spend the time. But as long as it's worth it, and we both know this, right? This is with like long form content that of people we really enjoy listening to or books we really enjoy reading. We don't care how long they are. Like when they're over, you wish they were longer. I'm sure people leave your class and think, wow, I can't believe that 4 hours just went by. Like you're like, that went by super fast, right?
I hope they feel that way. I really do. I know they feel exhausted at times from the pace. And that's the other part of it is I'm not a natural speaker. Like I don't, especially when I first started, I could look at my watch and see my heart rate. And I would be like 150, 160 at the start of the class. And the sheer amount, I always wear a black polo, and it's not a stylistic choice. It is, I sweat so much because the anxiety of getting ready to speak. And then again, I track my steps, and in a 4 hour class, I'll get 27,000 steps in.
Right.
So I'll walk like 12 miles while I'm teaching. And I'm sure that's very distracting. And it's something I work on. I tell people, hey, listen, this is me slowing down. Because I also talk like 90 miles to nothing, and I'm working on it, but I'm not a natural at it. I'm not.
I think it also depends on the day and how you're feeling, what else is going on in your life. And I've given presentations that I've given hundreds of times, and it's tight right when it's brand new. I remember doing just the opening for the Smoke Showing Conference, and it was the first time I built that opening just specifically for that day. And obviously I spent the time on it, and I read it, but it wasn't as smooth as like, man, if I could give that five more times, it would be so dialed in, right?
No, in fact, one of the things with the 9L, because the 9L started as a class, and Oklahoma City Fire, one of their training majors, asked if I could come in and do it early on to their Lieutenant's Academy. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to, man. That's a rep in front of people. And I got to do that probably four or five times before it ever became a class that went out on the circuit. And so those repetitions, I could really read, oh, that part falls completely flat. Oh, that really resonated. Double down on that. Oh, that joke worked well. More of that. There's nothing that replaces reps with your material. And I'm sure that, like, I'm sure stand-up comedians can tell you the same thing. You know, they work on a bit the first.
Yeah. It's the constant tweaking, man. That's what makes it better. And then every time you go to give it, you're excited to see how the new tweak works.
Mine is, I almost want to say one of the weaknesses of mine is how choreographed it is. Like, it is almost too dialed in. I want to, like.
Yeah. Right. Too verbatim. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Almost. I mean, it is, it's tight because of the style I use, which is the animated clicking, making my points. There is not a lot of room unless I pause that to expound on something and go off the reservation. Anyway, it's a weakness of the style, but I'll take that because it's very engaging. In fact, again, one of that same cat that told me this can't be the place because you said you and your dad built it. He was in Florida when I got to give it. And I was like, hey, dude, go catch whoever's speaking in the other room. You can see me anytime. He's like, no, chief, I want to see your class. And he sat through it. And his quote at the end was, hey, if you can keep my ADHD ass engaged, he goes, it was pretty good. And I was like, all right, so I'll take it. But it is engaging.
I've definitely found that if you can teach firefighters and like they leave feeling good about it, man, I honestly think you can teach anybody.
I think you hit the nail on the head, man.
Yeah. It really like hones you as like I've gone and given talks to just general public, and it's not to say the audience isn't, well, they're just kinder, right? They're just
right.
Gentler.
There is a level of T-ball instead of fast pitch or softball instead of fast pitch.
You're not dialing it down because they can't handle it. It's just that it's been so, you've been playing in the big leagues for so long that you're going to knock it out of the park because they're a kinder, gentler kind of audience.
Yeah. Dude, that is an excellent point, man. That is a massively good point.
Yeah. So segueing into that, how have you, I mean, obviously you're big on critical feedback, right? Constructive feedback. That's awesome. We always want to encounter that. But instructing as much as you have had to encounter guys that are just out to nail you down, or they don't want to listen to what you're having to say, the hecklers, the guys that want to carve you up. How was that experience with dealing with that, and how do you deal with it now? Have you turned that into a bit of an art, how you manage that in a class?
I'm getting better at it. And I'll be honest with you, Scott, I am one of the best people ever at the next day saying, I should have said this, the whole hindsight. I'm brilliant. But no, I think, again, it comes down to my empathy. And so I've been the person sitting in the class who has been told I have to be there and I don't want to be there. I've been the person in the class going, does this guy even know what he's talking about? And I've been the person, I've basically been, I don't want to say every one of them, but I have a high empathy for those people sitting in the room. So when I do detect that hostility, I think I handle it the way I would want to be handled. And then that's been a really good guidepost for me. Now, there's been times that I've been so angry because someone would do something that's just like, are you serious right now? You know, that kind of thing. Again, most of the time, I think it's just like, sometimes it's just they're the alpha in this situation and they're asserting their dominance in front of their peers because they want everybody to know they're still in charge. So I can either A, challenge that and say, no, I'm going to be the alpha in the room today, or I can let him have his 2 minutes of asserting, peeing on the room, and then go back to what I'm doing and holding the attention of the crowd. And I think that the main thing is the non-engagement. It's almost like my social media policy, which is 100%. I never, ever, 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 ever engage in confrontation on social media. Like, there is just zero gain. And I firmly believe that with all my heart and soul. Like, you cannot. And it's the same thing when you're teaching. There's no. Now, I'm not saying there's not a situation where it doesn't need to be addressed, because if it starts detracting from the class, you have to address it. You absolutely have to address it. But I haven't had anything escalate to that point. I've been able to de-escalate almost everything to a point. And truthfully, and I mean this, is that most of the time I can get them on my side. And if you do that, man, you win everything.
Yeah, and I was going to say to you, especially with your class, right? That random, like how you handle that moment, that's going to give the credibility and integrity to everything you're actually trying to say that day. Like there's a huge amount of learning for everybody in the room. I think it's obvious to everyone what's going on. I've had a lot of moments where I've been able to tactfully, artfully make it through that in a respectful way. And it's been a massive moment. And you don't have to play the gotcha card. It's not an argument you're trying to win. I've almost found even asking more questions and delving into like, can you tell me more about what you're trying to say? Like, and sometimes you'll ask questions and they'll hit a rope, they'll hit the end of their thought because they haven't been down the rabbit hole. And that's obvious to everybody. Or you're going to ask some questions and they're actually going to feel like they've got a voice and everyone can learn something. Maybe you can too. And yeah, I think those moments are valuable, man.
No, without a doubt. And if you can turn them into the class wins instead of I need to win or you need to win. If you turn it into I'm going to win or you're going to win, then everybody loses, including you and your time and everything like that. But if you can redirect it, like you said, with more questions, if you can like almost flow like water, do the Bruce Lee apply, you can absolutely turn it into the class wins. And then I love, like you said, questions are so powerful. And then saying, and I love being able to say, hey, I love the question. It's a great question. When we get to the seventh L, that's all we talk about. So if I haven't answered it when we get through that, then we'll come back and revisit it. What do you think? Is that fair?
It's too easy to have the knee-jerk reaction to, and you instantly, like you've talked about it, hey, you instantly want to start defending yourself.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, don't defend. Don't defend at all. Like, don't even defend. Just ask for more offense, right?
I think there's lots of things that instructors do. The sins of instruction. Hey, reading slides. Don't ever read a slide to me. I promise you, I've already read it by the time you're done reading it.
Yeah.
Breaks. Respecting their time and their breaks and the schedule. Respecting the schedule. I cannot believe how many people just don't give a rat's ass about the schedule. And it to me, it's a hubris thing almost to think my content is so important, it's more important than this schedule. Or my content is so important, it's more important than your bladder. Incorporate your breaks into and when you do that, it sends a message to the audience. Man, I respect you. Hey, let's all take 10 minutes. Let's stretch our legs. Let's get the blood flowing. I want you focused. So let's take a break and come back. Ready? Go.
And they'll process what you just said in that block, right? And they'll come back with some thoughts. And I think if they know that that's going to be the pace of the day, they're more engaged.
It's just respect. I mean, it really, really is. As an instructor, if there's micro, I don't want to say microaggressions, but there's these micro actions you can take. Because when a class sits down, voluntold or hopefully they want to be there. Want to be there is always better. They, you know, the people that paid to come or chose to come for whatever reason. That's always better. But either way, they give you a certain, it's like going to a movie. They give you a certain suspension of belief. You're going to see Lord of the Rings, let's say. You're suspending your belief to enjoy the movie. It's that goodwill. I'm going to believe that the one ring will turn you invisible type thing. You accept that. And they give you a certain amount of goodwill when it starts. And every action you take can either build on it or it can shrink it down till it's gone and they're just ready for it to be over. And once you lose it, you're not getting it back.
Yeah, that's the fun of it all, right? That's the, when you do that well.
Dude, it's so exciting. I'm a highly introverted person. So I'm the ISTP. I'm highly introverted.
Very much so.
But I'm a people person.
Yeah.
I'm a highly introverted people person, which is a crazy dichotomy. So interacting with them exhausts me to no end, but I love doing it.
Well, maybe you love interacting with people on the right things that energize you. And then you also need recovery time. If you reboot your batteries, you're good to go again.
Extremely true. Now, once you said it like that, you're right. That's a more articulated way to say it.
So you started the Firehouse Vigilance blog. Was the next thing the podcast? Did that follow on the footsteps and then the book? Was that the chronological order?
The blog had no success whatsoever. I mean, there was a few people reading the articles, but it was like, my message that I wanted to share was not getting out there at all. And that was frustrating because, of course, you want to have success, especially when you're first starting any new project. You're like, why isn't this doing well?
We weren't all in that medium at that time.
No, absolutely. And so then I started, my wife actually is the one who, she was a realtor. She still is a realtor, but she, at the time, realtors were doing a lot of, this was pre-COVID, but they were starting just basically Facebook Live and going live on Instagram has just started, you know, streaming had just started to go mainstream as far as going live in a house and saying, here's the house. It's an open house. You can check it out. You're walking through the house, showing the house off. And realtors were doing that quite a bit. And different influencers were doing it and going live and saying different things. And she said, hey, instead of writing your articles, why don't you go live and just talk about them instead? Right. And of course, me being me, I said, that's a dumb idea. I'm never going to do that. But she was right. And eventually I did. And so you can see the first 10 scraps, and that was the first original weekly scraps. It was me going live with my cell phone, and one of them was like 8 minutes long. One's like 12 minutes long. They're all like sub 15 minutes. But there were people, there would be a few people logging in and interacting, you know, two or three people would log in and interact, and it was nothing. Fast forward to the 11th episode. I went to a Fool's meeting, and my local Fool's president said, "Hey, Corley, I want to be on your show." And my reaction was, I didn't even know you know what my show is.
Yeah, I have a show.
And so he was the first guest I ever had. Now, that one, again, I think it was like 16 minutes long. He came on and talked about training, but I was hooked. Having a guest on and talking to them about what they're passionate about was, I was hooked. I was like, oh, this is it. And so that was late 2019. Of course, early 2020, COVID hit like in full force. And so everything in the world got canceled all at once. And right about the time I was like, I'm going to ask Rick Lasky to come be on my show. I'm going to ask Dave McGrill to come be on my show. I'm going to ask Rick George to come be on my show. And all of them all of a sudden had time on their hands, nothing better to do. And they came on, and the show grew and evolved over time. And it's probably the thing I'm most proud of is the consistency. At the end of the year, each year, Spotify will send you that recap of whatever. And it's like, you published 54 episodes this year. And I'm like, it's a weekly scrap. So that's right on pace, you know, 52 episodes this year. And I'm like, so I'm very proud of the consistency. And so much so that the consistency has become its own animal. And the fact of it's just, well, we can't do anything that day because it's a scrap. It's become its own self-reinforcing beast. You can't let it down.
So then what made you wanted to do them live streamed versus just recording a podcast, like say, like what we're doing today?
Here's the crazy part. It was never a podcast until, man, I might get my time frames wrong, but I had to go back and re-upload like the first 100 episodes as podcasts because all they were was lives. And then someone said, hey, I have a lot of trouble keeping the YouTube open or the Facebook open while I'm working out. Do you think you could do a podcast? And I was like, you know what? I don't know, but I'll find out. And it was a suggestion. I think it was around the 70s, in the episode 70 or so. I had to go back and re-upload all the originals as audio. And then from that point forward, they go out as podcast. But so it was never a podcast to begin with. It was just the live show and then interacting. But like I said, everything happens for a reason. And I mean this. It's a mantra. And people say it. But my son, when he was 15, so a few years before, I would say this about 2013, 2014, he wanted to be a video game streamer. And I didn't know what that was at the time. And I was like, what is a video game streamer? He's like, Dad, you play video games and people watch you play video games and they pay you money.
And you're like, what?
Like, that's not a thing, son. That doesn't happen. So he would pull up, you know, like Ninja or Insert, whoever the big names are. He would look at it and it would say $5. It would just scroll by $5, $2, $6, $7, $50, $20. People just paying them money while they're, of course, they're the best of the best of the best of the best, making millions of dollars a day doing this with endorsements and everything else. Not everybody who does it, not every kid that wants to be a streamer starts making money. But it was something. He convinced me, and we went and got him a gaming rig and got him the cameras and learned how to work OBS and overlays and how all that stuff works together. And so for a couple of years, I produced his stream and interacted with the audience and did the overlays and made everything work. I was like, wait a second, I can use OBS to put this out. Because at first it was just an Instagram thing, and then Instagram shut down the ability to do it with a guest. Because that was early on, you could bring a guest on Instagram. Then it went away. Then I went on Facebook, and then Facebook took away the ability to live stream with someone else because I guess streaming was still pretty new in the platforms. And so then I was like, how can I make this happen? And I was like, wait a second, the way my son did it, I can record like a Zoom call and then broadcast it to Facebook through OBS like a video game streamer does and then interact with the audience. And from that point forward, it's been really, really it's a unique space to occupy as a live firefighter stream and with interacting with the audience. I mean, you've been on and you know, we had stuff to talk about, but ultimately we talked about the questions from the audience for the bulk and majority of the show. They really do ask good questions. That's the cool part about it. It's not like they're asking left field questions that don't apply. They ask sometimes, not every time, but most of the time they ask better questions than me and the guest had planned to discuss.
Yeah, but within the same wheelhouse that you're there to talk about. So it's really cool.
They keep it right in the down the pipe so that the guests can crush it or whatever, but it has a little more, just another take on another. It's more diverse in its approach.
Yeah, Kyle's right about how I think you're the only one doing it this way, which is really cool. Like you have your, this is what you do. This is for the fire service. You're occupying that space of this style of how that content is produced. So it's amazing. Really enjoy it.
Thank you. Hey, I'm like I said, I'm the luckiest dude in the fire service because I'm a firefighter from Moore, Oklahoma. Okay, it's a four station, 60,000 people in the town department. We're not job town. We get leveled by tornadoes every 4 or 5 years or whatever. But I am blessed and lucky enough to get to talk to, well, A, Scott from Multiple Calls Podcast. I get to talk to Ray McCormick, Kurt Isaacson. I get to call these people friends forever because of the medium and the platform. The best part about it is people say, hey, thanks for doing that. And I'm like, that blows my mind like I said, I'm just so lucky, man. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. It's crazy that I get to do it and then people say, thank you for doing it.
Yeah, I haven't made my way all the way back. I've been working my way back. I'm staying current with your episodes and then working my way backwards. I'll do the one the next day and then I'm on the... So I think I'm back to like, I think it's 122 Bastinelli, which was that's a banger of an episode. It was so good.
You're so good at pulling out great clips and posting them, man. I was like, dang, because you pulled out Bastinelli the other day and you broke it out. And I was like, it was a really good one, man. And that's the part where my ignorance comes through because I get so jealous of people who can do that. And I try, don't get me wrong. I make a lot of content and I try, but mine is so, I have to work so hard to put it in my editor.
Well, just to give you a behind the scenes, like on just, that's the podcast app I use called Overcast. It's called Overcast. And just as you're listening, you can choose, you know, as if you would share it, right? You click that upper right box with the arrow. And it gives you the opportunity to share the link. So then it would instantly copy the link. So you can like text that to somebody or DM them. Or it's share clip from the middle of, like, it'll start, like, it'll give you a clip so much before when you just clicked and so much after. And then you can just slide the sliders and replay it and replay it. And then once you have the clip you want, you just save the video and then that's it. It's done. So.
Oh, you have your content right there.
Yeah. So as I'm listening to things, I'd be like, that, damn, that was amazing. People need to hear that. Right. So that's always my thing in my head. People need to hear that. So
I love it when I see what you tag me and I see it and I post it and I'm like, I love it. And I feel bad because I don't do the same thing with my own or with others. You know what I'm saying? And it's like,
well, you've got a lot going on though, right? If you're doing a weekly show, you've got a lot and you're a chief we're going to get there, but.
And I'm still jealous of it.
Dude, I wish I could do it weekly too. So, you know, we always have this, I wish I could be doing more mentality, but we're all doing what we do and supporting each other. And again, I think as much as the social media gets vilified in our culture, like it's probably been the best thing that's happened to the fire service in a long time.
I love it. And I think the key is don't engage. I'll say that again.
Engage, but engage in the right way. How about that?
No, engagement is awesome. And engagement is magical. Engagement is the key. Don't engage in conflict is what I should qualify it and say.
Pick your battles, right?
Don't battle on social media is what I say. I really mean that. And people can agree or disagree, but I feel like everyone loses when you get into a back and forth shouting match through comments.
But so let me drop you a different perspective on that. Okay. So there has been a way I've found to some, I definitely will. I mean, I'll just outright delete and block because again, you become a bit of a, you can tell what's what, right? So some are like instant block, instant delete, you're gone. It's not about censorship. It's just like, I know why you're here and there's no benefit to it. But some comments I've responded to and then I actually get a lot of people following up with liking and really appreciating the way that I, again, just like I see it as instructing in the class and you get that person making that comment. And then Matt, who helps us do all the promos and the images and logos and stuff for the podcast, he brought it up a really great point too, that the more you do that properly and really well, your audience, that's your regulars, they'll start policing it themselves. Like it'll just self-police itself.
You're creating the culture of your page.
Yeah. So there is, but again, that takes some time and energy and effort. It all depends on the time of day. And if you've got the energy to actually get engaged in a, and like you got to make your point. You got to be very succinct, right? Very succinct, non-emotional, straight to it.
And you make a great point because I say this all the time, there's a dichotomy to everything. There is no either or. I mean, roll with me when I say always and never, but there's a dichotomy to everything. And so there is a downside to not engaging ever, which is you don't get to cultivate that culture. And there is a downside to engaging in the fact that it can spiral and turn into an emotional argument. Yeah. And so there's always a trade-off. I don't think anything is ever free, or not that it's free. I don't think anything comes without a cost, whether it's social cost or a trust cost or respect, you know, some sort of.
And sometimes it's worth it and sometimes it's not.
That's it. Is the juice worth the squeeze? And some people absolutely thrive off of the engagement. To me, like I'd rarely ban or block anyone. Like if someone comments, I don't care how heinous it is, it can stay. And other people can go crazy and post and argue about it. I don't mind that at all. I'm just not going to engage and get drug into it. The only thing I block really is spam. And that, again, there's a cost to everything.
Or there's people that will comment and you'll go to reply to them and you get the message saying you're not allowed to comment back to them. That to me is a red flag. It's like, well, you can't make a comment and then have it set in your profile that you can't receive comments back. So if you're not going to engage in a dialogue, then I don't do well with the one way.
I'm just here to drop my...
Yeah. Getting back to your journey, when did you choose to promote? Like, walk me through the ranks now and how that happened for you.
Lucky is one of the stories of my life. And I say lucky, but I'm blessed. I was a firefighter for 12 years, I think I want to say. And then we opened a fourth station, which created seven driver's positions all at once. And I got the seventh position by the skin of my teeth. And in fact, the day of the practical, there was mathematically no way possible for me to make up the points that I needed, even if I aced the practical. And I did. I was very proud. I made 100 out of 100 on the practical. But there was no way possible because there wasn't enough. I couldn't make up enough points. And someone had a DNF, did not finish. That was ahead of me. One of the few people ahead of me did not finish. And so mathematically, that was the only way it could happen, was them get a zero. Them, if they would have made a 1 point, they would have been ahead of me. But since they didn't fit, they had to make passing. So I think it had to be a 70. But if they'd have made a 70. So anyway, long story short, skin of my teeth, I made driver. And it's always been a running joke. Me and the union president, at one point, I was heavily involved in the union and the e-board and things like that. But we were revamping our promotional process. And he was saying, well, I don't think someone who just barely, I don't think people should be promoted if they're sixth, seventh down on the list. And I was like, sorry, but I was sixth or I was seventh on the list, you know, and it's a small department. So the number on the list can be varying depending on the size, but just the percentage wise. And so he's like, well, damn it, Corley, quit being the freaking guy that's, oh, yeah, just funny. But that's the reason I originally promoted, was by the skin of my teeth, backdoored a driver's position. And so that, of course, the drivers is where all the company officers come from in our organization. So once you're into that pool, and at the time, the captain's test, which was the next level up, was which is company officer in our organization. It was very, very book oriented, heavy, heavy testing. And that's always been I've always been good at taking tests. And so I was number one on the captain's test. So I was much more proud of that score than I was on the driver's test. And I was only a driver for about 3 years. So about 15 years on when I made it to captain. And I love, love, love company officer. It is the greatest job, I think, in my opinion. My opinion only. It was borne out on the first 100 and so episodes of the 5 questions for firefighters, because that was one of the original questions. And that was company officer. And this all was around the same time as I met Mark Von Oppen and all that stuff going on in my life. And I started reading like culture books and how to build high performance and things like that, getting exposed to Jocko and extreme ownership and all these different leadership principles, Simon Sinek, Leaders Eat Last, the culture code, Daniel Coyle, all these things that just really shaped the way I wanted to run a firehouse. I had a Petri dish. My own Petri dish, and it was awesome. Like, it was, to this day, those guys on that first crew, we still talk about how awesome it was. And I got 4 months with that crew and trying out those things, and I learned a lot. Don't get me wrong. They assigned me an old driver that was done. He was on his way out the door, and you couldn't pry him out of a chair if you wanted to. He was the mouch. Absolutely, I learned how to leverage his once existing passion back into the forefront, and him become I learned so much from him. It was a great time. And then 4 months is what we got together. And then another battalion chief pulled me to his shift. I didn't even know. I got the call. I was at a fire academy class, DeMisio, decision-making initial company operations, DeMisio class. And I got the call and they said, hey, next shift, you're reporting to red shift. And I was like, what? And it was devastating to my crew, to me. It was. One of the cool things that happened from that was I got to have an exit interview with all that crew and talk to them and ask them, hey, what did you think of what we did here? You know what I'm saying? Because I was super proud of it. And it was actually kind of shocking because a couple of the guys that I really had a good relationship with, they said, hey, Chief, or at the time, hey, Cap, we need you to make decisions better. It's not always about everybody gets a say. Sometimes we just want to be told what to do. And that was an eye-opening thing for me because all my life, I just wanted to be involved in the decision-making process. So that was very important to me, to give people autonomy and things like that. But again, it's that part of that process of learning, everything's a dichotomy, everything. There is always a cost to whatever you're doing. And so that was a cool lesson learned. And it made and turned me into a more decisive firehouse leader, not just fireground. There's a time and a place for everybody gets a vote. And there's a time and a place to say, hey, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, because I guess if you're always making decisions as a group and as a team, then why are you not all just the same rank? Like, why would you have a rank above? So obviously you have a rank above because there's times where one decision's going to be made.
And reading that situation and figuring out which method is going to leverage the most organizational trust, which one is going to build the most organizational trust at whatever level you're at. And that's the metric to use, I think, each and every time is which of these methods, and it's not just those two methods, every decision you make should be put through that lens, I think, is which one will foster more organizational trust.
So then what about the next step to chief?
Man, that was the toughest one, plain and simple. Toughest one, 2019. And honestly, for the first 6 months after I did it, maybe even the first year, there wasn't hardly a day or shift that went by that I didn't think about stepping back. But luckily, I did grow into it. And I'm not a paperwork person. I'm not good at record keeping. And my small part of the budget that I have to take care of, that's my small responsibility. And I'm not good at that. That's not my forte. I'm an action-oriented person. I love being physical. I love training. And I loved for 22 years being a firefighter.
Crisis management, not project management.
Yes. And being a firefighter too, because the biggest part was stepping off the engine and realizing I'm no longer a firefighter. I am now a chief officer. That's a special kind of mind fuck after a while.
It's an identity hit.
Yeah. No, that's why I really worry when I retire, because I now know I'm still a firefighter, but in our organization, we battalion chiefs are not expected to fight fire in any way, shape, or form. I know there's a lot of places where they show up in the buggy and they go and do stuff. And I could, in some extreme circumstance, still go to work, but it's just not going to happen in the run of the mill organization and the day-to-day operations. But anyway, long story short, that was a tough one, but I realized I get to, and I love Eric Sailors. He's he was out of San Francisco Fire. I forget the actual department he's now the chief of. But one of my questions back in the day was, what is the greatest position to have in the American Fire Service? It's the one I referenced earlier, where company officer was always the answer. And I loved his answer to it. In fact, I still live by it to this day, because he said, it's always the position you're in, okay? Which is a cop-out answer, kind of, sort of, you know what I'm saying? Because I don't like people who give, that don't answer the question, okay? So that don't get you max points if you give a cop-out answer. But then he said, here's the deal, Corley. He says, when you're a firefighter, your job is to take care of the people with the problem. He goes, and when you promote, your job is to take care of the people who take care of the people who take care of the problem. And then when you go up one more level, you take care of the people who take care of the people who take care of the problem. And I was like, man, that's a beautiful way of looking at, my job now is to take care of the people who take care of the people who take care of the problem. And it's just, and when you look at it that way and you do it, man, it's powerful what you can build.
That all the positions in the team are important.
Oh yeah. And the empowerment of it, the autonomy, the ability for people to make decisions, instilling that ability for people to make decisions at their level. Like, that's so, so, so important. It's not command and control. I'm building this new class for firemanship that's coming up in July, and I'm super excited about it. But one of the things that early on I realized is the fire service, I'll try not to go rabbit hole too bad, but fire service has got two worlds. I mean, everybody knows this. We got the fireground, emergency operations, and we got the firehouse. And depending on the level of job town you work at, how busy you are, the firehouse is 70 to 95% of the day, and the calls are at a busy place, 30% to down to like 5% of the day, depending on where you work and the calls. The leadership style that works in one does not work in the other, or one is more effective. I'll say that. They work because we clunk along no matter what. But the effectiveness of firehouse leadership is because we promote based on, generally speaking, we promote based on fireground competence, generally speaking. And if they happen to be good at firehouse or leadership, then that's great. That's a bonus. But we promote on fireground competence. And a lot of times that doesn't promote the best and most healthy firehouse environments.
No, and that ties, like you said, into your name, the Firehouse Vigilance. It's great that you call it Firehouse Vigilance, because that speaks to the point you're saying right now. And you could have called it Fireground Vigilance, right? And it would have been very focused on that one small niche of the job. But you're right. The bulk of what makes people good on the fireground starts in the firehouse.
there's so much impact from your firehouse culture on the fire ground. So much. And it's not necessarily in reverse. And I'll put the caveat, unless you work in Jobtown, in which case the fire ground culture can absolutely drive.
Well, they definitely impact each other, for sure. Ideally, you'd have both.
I will say the broad brush American Fire Service, not the highly specific Jobtown, urban, getting it on, you know, just dirty, nitty gritty. I'll say suburban, rural fire department. The firehouse culture matters. It impacts so at such a high level.
I think it was in your episode with Frank Lieb where you sort of dove into how the 9Ls came to be, the book, right? I think you told that story there. So I think I can direct people to, I mean, that's a great episode all around too. So like, listen to it.
I can listen to Frank all day.
Oh, I know, for sure. For sure. But how's the book doing? Like, how has that been getting it out there?
Every day copy sale on Amazon. And that's, I'm so lucky and blessed. Somebody unknown. And I know the scrap has a big, big, big part of it. The fact that the scrap does so well is the fact that the 9Ls. But I'm blessed to be an unknown, self-published guy, and it's doing well. And I'm very, very proud of it. It's being put on some promotional processes across the country. About once a month, someplace new contacts me and says, hey, we're putting this on our promotional process.
Oh, it's huge, man. It's so huge.
What can you say to that?
That's a goosebumps thing, man.
Yes, man. It's like, I love it. I love talking about me. Don't get me wrong. Okay. But I also feel like I'm just talking about me, and that feels weird.
That's what this is all about. Well, dude, you expect all your guests to come on and talk about themselves. So flip the script.
That is true. Right? Yeah. The reversal. Someone was coming on and they said, hey, I have a great idea for our scrap. Okay. And they're a good friend and they're coming on and they're like, I want to do this and I want to talk about this and this and you and this and this. And I said, hey, here's the deal, brother. I said, I don't advertise like this. It's hard to explain, but I'm sure you can understand after the number of episodes you've done. Is when I started, I was just doing it. And then you start to realize, oh, this works, that does. It's the evolution. And then over time, these kind of like rules solidify, whether you actually write them out as concrete,
yep, in concrete,
you know, chisel them out or not. Yes. But you get these principles that you're like, okay, this is the principle of the show. And one of the principles of the scrap is it's never about me. And I had to tell him, I said, the thing is, I love what you're saying. That's cool. I would love to have that discussion, but the scrap is never about me. It's always about the guests. And if I ever lose sight of that principle, I don't want to ever lose sight of that principle, because the guests will always be interesting. If I talk every week, especially after 200 episodes,
we run into things to talk about.
Well, everybody's going to hear everything I have to. I don't have that much interesting stuff right. to say. Yeah. We're almost to the end right now.
You can feel it. You can feel it coming. Yeah.
No, I'm just.
But if we never stepped up and told some perspectives from ourselves, then people are going to benefit. People are going to benefit from hearing something from everybody. So people can benefit from hearing some of the small things that we have to offer too. It's all part of the conversation. And I want to be at the table and just be part of the conversation. I don't need to be the center or the focus. I love echo and amplifying and promoting other people and like holding them up. And I love that part of it, but it's really cool to be part of the conversation, of the general kitchen table.
Different people have different gifts as hosts. And some people are very good at taking a question and diving in and asking. I don't know if you ever listened to Chris Williamson. He does Modern Wisdom. It's one of my favorite podcasts right now. If you haven't listened to it, check it out. It is amazing. He is like, just listen to his style. He is so good at asking good questions. I try to learn from him. I'll put it that way. But long story short, there are different styles. And I really appreciate yours, because yours is, A, what's your story? Then you start picking at the threads of that story and then asking for expounding. And it's good. It's solid. And the reason I say that is because, like you said, everybody has something to offer. And so anyway, I don't want to say it like the podcast should never speak at all. I don't mean it like that. It's one of those principles where...
Yeah, in that arena of your show, this is the way you do it. And you hold to
it. No, and the other part is unlike right now, the audience is going to get to hear this later, but there's no audience listening right now interacting. And so the other part of mine is I have to keep the audience involved as well as the guest. If I put me in there too, then now there's three instead of just two.
And that's the kitchen table, man. That's the kitchen table right there.
You nailed it.
Yeah. I guess that's what we're speaking to now, but maybe to put it more concrete in words and ask you the question, like, has it really benefited you to see yourself as a firefighter or a member of the fire service as a whole, even internationally, versus just a firefighter in your department, as much as you may love your department? Do you feel a part of the fire service as a whole? Like, you're a firefighter in just the title, like overall, like I think you can be in your department You could even bring it down to even being on your platoon or being on your crew. You could have a very, very tunnel visioned. And then, you know, a lot of instructors and the great people you've had on talk about how it's important to get outside your firehouse, get outside your fire department. So I think I kind of tie it to frustration sometimes. So if you're solely looking in your total microscope view as your department or your platoon or your crew, problems can be really amplified for you because that's all you're seeing. But if you see yourself as a member of the fire service as a whole, there's a lot more good and great. And I mean, obviously you bring in bigger problems too, but I think if you're always feeling a part of a bigger, the more you feel a part of a bigger thing, the better, right? As opposed to just a smaller thing. Yeah. So I'm always wondering what your take on that was.
No, I'll give you Brian Brush's quote, which he gave to me a few years ago. And we were outside of his burn facility doing a live burn with some of our rookies. And he turned to me, and I don't remember exactly the discussion, but I can remember him saying this to me to this day. And he said, "Corley, once a person gets outside of the walls of their fire department, they realize that the fire service has no walls." And it was one of those, holy smokes. The mission of the fire service, we're always going to belong to that bigger thing. But it's not until you get outside the walls of it, your own department, do you realize, and does it really impact what you belong to?
Yeah, you can belong to something, but not even know you belong to it or feel it in your bones.
You said it perfectly with tunnel vision, looking through a straw.
Yeah. You talk a lot about humility. I think that really brings humility into focus too for people. When you realize what's out there and who's out there and what's come before, and that's really what you get, that goosebumps or blood drain from your head, and you realize how big this is and then how cool it is. And then gratitude comes in, right? Being grateful for being part of it and then wanting to live up to it. So I just find it's something that keeps me going, as opposed to being stuck in the small issues that you may be encountering within your own department.
Right on. No, I love it. I love it.
Let's finish off just by you touching more on the next book. I know you've mentioned it a couple times, but maybe just give me a bit more before we sign off.
It's the book that won't end. That's what I keep calling it. No, me and my wife, my lovely wife, Amanda, we decided to write a book on relationships. We've been married. We've been together 30 years. We've been married 27 and three beautiful kids. And we've been from the peaks of bliss to the valleys of teetering on divorce and everything in between, and knockdown, drag out fights, not physical, just the arguments and the despair and the let's give it up, this ain't worth it. And basically, long story short, it's everything we wish we'd have known at the beginning. Now, not saying we'd had the maturity to listen to it. It's actually called You, Me, and Our Broken Tools. That's the name of the book. You, Me, and Our Broken Tools. And it's kind of in the name, is the fact that we all have these broken tools that we go through life with and deal with. And it's an understanding that my tools are not your tools. And when you get with someone else and try to form a life with someone else, they're bringing their own broken tools to the party. And they do stuff and you're like, why would they ever do that? And it really is, in a nutshell, it's about grace for each other and learning to grow together and learning to recognize our own broken tools, not our partners, working on ourselves and working on a relationship so that we can have a healthy relationship that can go forever. And so it's a relationship book. Frank Lieb, I asked him and his wife would write the foreward for it, and amazing. They graciously read the book.
Wow,
and
that's cool, yes. Man. Very cool.
It really, you were so nervous to ask someone, and then then you ask them, and then you send them a copy of the book, which... The copy we sent was a very early draft, the very first draft. And since then, we've probably changed, I'd say 40% of the content. Because like I said, it's the book that won't end. We've just been editing, and I have a really, really good editor. One of the company officers that I work with, he's phenomenal at, sometimes infuriatingly so, but not the point. He's amazing. He did the 9 L's. He's the one who did a lot of the work. And he has his own page I dedicated to him in the back because of how much work he did. But long story short, it's close. I think February 14th is kind of, it kind of works out that February 14th, Valentine's, is going to be hopefully the release date. If we can wrap up these final few edits, and it's so close.
But how cool that you had another couple that you admire, not just Frank Lee, but like you have him and his wife, like you have that couple do the foreword together.
Oh, and they crushed it. Dude, it's they call it dancing above the clouds. And it's like their little foreword is amazing. And I can't think. Again, it's that trepidation when you send it out and you're like, what if they say they don't want to? How am I going to respond to that? But they didn't. So very, very, very proud.
with the editing, that's why there's second and third, fourth, fifth editions of books. Like eventually, just like a podcast, right? Like I remember now I listen back to the early ones and I want to go back and edit them all over again because it was a learning process. And yeah, I'm blessed now to have Brad editing and he's really smooth with it. And I don't imagine he should never look back and think he should re-edit them because he's amazing at it, better than me. But yeah, you can always look back and go, I wish I would have, could have, right, should have, right? Yeah.
No, that's one thing about Scrap. This is one thing I love over anything is it's recorded raw and live. And when it's over, I do some editing. I put the sound at the beginning and the sound at the end. And unless there's just a massive technical snafu in the middle where there's dead space, it goes out raw. And that's, I don't know if that's good or bad, but
no, it's good, man. It's good.
I don't have to polish it too much. It's very raw and I get forgiven because it's live.
Right. That's awesome.
A lot of grace from the audience.
You give it, you get it.
That's the theme of the day.
That's the thing, man. You give it, you get it, right? Well, I guess to paraphrase you, it's Corley Moore, Fire Ace Vigilance, Weekly Scrap. I appreciate you, brother. I really appreciate you.
Dude, thank you. I had a blast talking to you today. It was a lot of fun, man.
Yeah, I'm glad we're connected and we'll do some more.
No, I love it. I look forward to coming up to the Great White North at some point.
People should know how to get a hold of you, but do you want to just drop how people can reach out to you?
Firehousevigilance.com is like the one-stop shop for everything. You can find the podcast there. Of course, any social media platform, if you look for Firehouse Vigilance, you should be able to find it. Twitter, or I guess it's X now. I don't know if anybody uses it. LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. Not on TikTok. I think it is. I think there is one, but I don't do anything there. I deleted it off my phone at one point. And
I've never even delved into it. Twitter and TikTok I've avoided, yeah.
Yeah, firehousevigilance.com. Very, very, very excited. Got to mention the vigilantes because you are now a vigilante. I love it. And it's an awesome group and it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun with the forums and the fireaways. And we have a forum coming up with Sean Duffy is coming on to do a forum on nothing but search and culture. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Cool. Good talking to you.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Thank you for being a guest. And we'll schedule another one probably in about a year or so.
Would love to.
Come on and do it again.
Thank you so much. All right. I'll talk to you soon, bro.
Awesome, brother. See you.